a subcommittee of every other subcommittee.
Okay.
Everybody ready to rock and roll?
Just looking at.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for March the 27th, 2017. We are gathered today for the purpose of a public hearing on Senate Bill 5540, the Oregon Department of Transportation. We need to add to the agenda our Chief Financial Officer, Linnea Wittekind, and apologies for leaving you off the agenda. We'll start with Mr. Director Garrett and Team ODOT of your choosing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. So today we'll bring Mr. Mather up. Mr. Mather has about 10 minutes of material that he'll present. We'll clear the highway portfolio. After any questions you may have of this gentleman, bring Mr. Guard up to continue the conversation on rail and transit. We have a host of questions that we were asked. We will bring back the responses to those. And then finally, we will bring Robert Gephardt up to walk through the central services portfolio. So we hope to get through it today, Madam Chair. So with that, I turn to Mr. Mather, unless there's any questions of me.
I don't see any. Mr. Mather, sign in, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Member of the Committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. I wanted to start, Madam Chair, with just a clarification of an answer I gave you last time on wet signatures. You'd asked me whether there was all our documents were available for e-signatures or electronic signatures, and I had said they were, and actually there's three documents we're still working on. So then we should have those in order this fall. So we're close, but we still have three that DOJ is having us sign as wet signatures, but we're getting there.
Inquiring minds want to know. The whole world accepts electronic signatures. What's wrong with DOJ?
Madam Chair, there are specific documents in our contracts, so we just got to get the right protocols in place to be able to have legally sufficient signatures and electronic signatures. And we got a pathway, we just got to walk through it and get those right processes in place, and we'll have that by this fall.
I guess travel's at the speed of government. Fall? That's 6 months away. Okay, enough said.
Yep.
Thank you for the clarification.
We're working on it. It's going to be a great improvement. There are just those three documents we got left to do. I last left you on page 9, where I was going over various improvements to our program and delivery. The next one that I wanted to get on is on the top of page 9. This is the use of road salt in our five-year pilot that we've been under. Since 2012, there's a couple of sections of Highway 1 in far southeast Oregon and the other right on the California border with I-5 where we've been using road salt as a test pilot. And it's not testing whether road salt's effective or not. We know it's very effective. The test is really how can we integrate that into our normal repertoire toolbox full of tools that we use, whether it's plowing, sandy material, or de-icer. How can we do it in a way that limits its use and still be very effective? And we've proven to ourselves that we can do that, and we've also shown other benefits by reducing crashes, closures, and other parts of our system. So our next step is to expand that pilot area, and we're looking at two areas that we're going to expand into, both on the interstate, one in eastern Oregon on I-84, from I-82, including I-82, back east towards Idaho and Ontario. The other is further north on I-5 through those various summits in southern Oregon up to Canyonville. Those are both areas where we see a lot of winter travel, a lot of winter closures, so forth, so we see the use in those areas. It's going to cost us about $10 million to put the infrastructure in place to be able to do that. You'll also, you know, note that this winter we also, on a case-by-case basis, will use salt elsewhere in our system, on the freeway system, where the situation warrants itself. So we'll continue to do that as well going forward.
Question?
Senator Hansel. I need sunglasses to look at that sweater. I'm sorry.
I would certainly be supportive of some of these efforts. One of the things we're finding in my part of the state is that when the interstates are coming between, like Washington and Idaho, like I-84 does, I-82-84, is that when one state's using protocols such as salt, which I believe both Washington and Idaho are doing in certain conditions, that our truckers are coming off of those kind of roads. They're clearer and safer and more easily traveled, and they hit the Oregon roads, and it's a whole different confusion, and we've had some pretty bad winters, particularly this year, that we need to fight, and I think it'll really help with interstate commerce. Plus, we have two horrendous passes, both Cabbage Hill and Ladd Canyon, on the interstate, that if we can cut down on the fatalities and the wrecks there, I think this certainly bears, it would be a good place to put those protocols in. I'd be very supportive.
Chair Johnson, Senator Hansel, you articulated exactly why we're looking at that section. Good. So moving on, I want to touch on a couple other ones. One is our culvert improvements. Director Garrett touched on this in his introduction. I just wanted to highlight some specifics of work that we've done working with ODF and NW. We have a pilot agreement with them, a three-year agreement. We're actually in the process of negotiating an extension of that agreement. In the first year of that program, We repaired six culverts that we originally had planned for replacement. Those six replacements would have cost us $36 million. We were able to do a long-term repair on all six of those for $750,000. So just in those six culverts was well worth the agreement that we went through with ODF&W. We paid them $1.9 million that they were able to use elsewhere on their system to free up more habitat for fish. And so both us and ODF&W are thinking it's really a win-win for the fish and for the taxpayer on the for the road system. That's just first year. We've still got another year within the pilot and then looking to expand that into the future. I also want to touch on the work that we're doing with our local program. Some of you may know the process of federal funds must come through ODOT for federally funded local projects, and oftentimes we end up being in the middle of helping or assisting local governments in delivering their projects per federal standards and federal contracting. Many jurisdictions use those on a very infrequent basis, and having them to understand the various protocols with federal makes it difficult. And so we're working through to do what we call the fund exchange and allow them to use state funds for that work rather than federal funds.
Mr. Mather, how many of those fund exchanges do you do? Because ostensibly you're switching out color of money. Is that a prevalent practice? You do it a lot? Who do you do it for? I think you do it for TriMet.
Chair Johnson, the program that I'm talking about is we're going to be doing that for all local funded projects outside of the three TMAs, so outside of Eugene.
TMA.
Transportation Management Area, so it's Eugene, Salem, and Portland, those larger MPOs. All the federally funded projects outside of that, we're going to be doing the fund exchange on. Inside those areas, we're going to be using what we call a certification program and certifying those frequent users of federal funds the same way we are certified by Federal Highway, so they can have authority to move their projects forward without our involvement. What we're trying to do is get them into the driver's seat of their projects and really get us out of the car so they can steer and take their projects where they want to go without us being involved in the project.
Thank you.
The last piece I just want to touch on, this is some just innovative work. It's relatively small, but I think it just highlights some of how technology is helping us out and making the system more efficient. So these are traffic signals on 101 in Lincoln City. If we've been there in the summertime, you know the congestion in Lincoln City that we see. There's actually 7 traffic signals we focused on, if you're familiar with the Outlet Mall and then north towards 22nd. Your typical kind of old school traffic signal will sit there and go the same time all day long, green, yellow, red, back and forth, no variability at all. About 30 years ago, we introduced some new technology in traffic controllers that were able to adjust time of day. So we had one timing for the morning peak and then during the day and then a different one in the evening and then at night a different time. What we tried there in Lincoln City this last summer was actually introduce a piece of software for those 7 signals at the cost of about $2,000 and really let them talk to each other and continually adjust their timing so they can optimize no matter what traffic is coming at them. They continue to optimize their use of green time for the side street as well as for 101 and promote that platooning you see between the traffic signals. What we found was we were able to improve in the northbound direction about a 5% decrease in travel time. Southbound, we were able to do a 23% decrease in travel time. So for $2,000, just in those few blocks, we're able to see something. So we're encouraged that we'll be able to use that in other parts of our system in a very cost-effective way. The last thing I wanted to touch on was just a couple of performance measures. Turning to the performance measure number 16 on page 24, I want to talk a little bit about construction projects completion and our timeliness. This is, if you look through our KPMs, this is one that I'm probably the least proud of the timeliness of our project. You see we struggled to hit our target time there. This is a measure that was pointed out in the McKinsey study where we need to continue to do work on the timeliness of our projects. One of the things we're looking at following up on the McKinsey study was the definition that we use for this, looking at the other states that they benchmarked us against, Utah, Nevada, and Washington. We noticed that they were using a schedule that was the latest schedule, so when they process a change order, they would adjust the schedule. In our definition, you'll note we stick with the original date regardless of any changes we make during the contract. So. Anyway, we got more work to do on the schedule one, and we'll continue to follow up on that from the McKinsey report. The next one I want to touch on was the next KPM, number 17, on page 26.
Before you leave that one, how much of the failure to meet your targets are the fault of other people? Change orders on contracts that it takes DOJ forever to get out, or... have you had adequate time to analyze what are the drivers here? Because if there's stuff beyond your control, I don't know why necessarily you should get gigged on a KPM that makes it look as though you're not performing.
Chair Johnson, we're still looking into that. I think your reference to DOJ as an example is probably more true on our A&E contracts, but in our construction contracts, probably less. Our design contracts.
Thank you.
So we do. And our construction contracts less so, but we're still kind of diving in and diagnosing what's going on. But as I talk about this next KPM, I'll come back to that. So for our construction projects, when you look at a program level, when I was here on Thursday, I talked about the Jobs and Transportation Act projects and the OTIA projects and how we came in on budget at those program areas. And as you see in this graph there on 17, or KPM number 17, we hit those marks at a program level or a year level almost every year and take pride in looking at those things. But when you saw in the McKinsey report that when you dived into on a project-by-project basis, there's actually high variability where you have as many above and many below. This graph here really shows the balance of those things. And so kind of getting back to our schedule conversation a little bit, the two things that we hold up when we look at our projects are really that overall budget, knowing that we can't come back here and ask for additional money. So we will look to adjusting those with other projects. The other thing we hold up is our customer and community interface that we have to make sure we're serving their needs. Those are the primary things, and the McKinsey report again validated both those things. But as you look at a project, you always have something you got to give on, whether it's scope, schedule, or budget. There's only so many kind of levers you have. And that schedule one I talked about previously, is probably the one where we'll throttle back on. If we've got to meet a customer need or deal with a cost issue or a contract issue, that's usually the performance measure that we throttle back on to make sure we hit that program budget and we keep our customers happy. So anyway, some interface between those three project performance measures. The last piece that I want to touch on was Representative Reardon's comment from last Thursday in the Orphan Highway conversation. You should have on OLIS and received the PowerPoint that I have on orphan highways. It goes through and kind of explains what an orphan highway is. Just quickly, what that is if you're in local government and you got to kind of prioritize your needs and where your budget goes through, kind of what falls out the bottom, or maybe your county roads that go to three residents or your neighborhood streets that are really low volume roads. We do the same thing. The problem is our roads are at the bottom end of the state priority, our key roads in communities, and sometimes the top end of vital roads in community, whether it's 82nd Avenue, Powell Boulevard, and some of those other ones. They're on the lower end of our priorities, but they're in the top end of others. And that's where the orphan highway kind of comes from. You'll also notice in the PowerPoint, as Senator Johnson pointed out last time, there's kind of five different scenarios of where you could actually do some trades of highways or roadways that should come ODOT's direction and things that should go towards the local government. So just kind of framing the issue and putting some ideas out there that is probably best part of a funding package. And that the other thing you'll notice in the presentation, the crux of the issue is there's not enough money to fund these highways. And so as we turn them over, if we turn those roads over to local governments, they're not in very good shape and there's not a lot of funding that goes with them. And that really becomes the kind of the crux of the issue. With that concludes my prepared remarks.
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question about coming on time or in on budget. What do you think you're doing to, have through the budget process and the bidding process to make sure that you're coming in on budget? Or I just want to find out, what are your keys to your success? Because it's always great to see that we're coming in on budget. And want to find out if there's any accounting tricks going on. I'm just kidding, but how we're able to really—that's a good record.
Chair Johnson, Representative Meek, we adjust, as I said, kind of those different levers you have to pull on a project, whether it's scope, schedule, or budget. We're constantly talking in those terms and managing those terms. We have what we call a change management process in the department where we bring our different programs and our project managers and our region folks together to continue to look where we have issues with projects and then decide where the trade-offs are to keep things on track the best we can. A lot of those kind of tools and techniques we learned going through the OTIA 3 Bridge program, and we continue now to apply those to our normal program.
Great work. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Noble.
Thank you. Just as a side note, my favorite project right now, of course, is Newburgh-Dundee. And I understand that we're going to be on time, and I've been told that we've actually been under budget and been able to allocate money to new right-of-way purchase for phase two. Phase one's on time, not the project, but phase two. Just any comments about that and anything unique about that project? Because $10 million under budget seems to be significant.
Chair Johnson, Representative Noble, yes. First, we are expecting to open the bypass this fall, late this fall. We expect to have those three contracts that we have underway now done and open, and already starting to think about what a ribbon cutting would look like there and kind of looking forward to that. But I think it also highlights, I think, your point about just that scope, schedule, budget. So we, going into this project and coming out of the 09, the Jobs and Transportation Act, one of the things that was built in for this project was the assumption of a federal earmark was going to come to help fill about, I believe it was around $30 million additional for this project. About that same time, Congress decided they weren't doing earmarks anymore. And so we had expectations kind of at one level and funding at a lesser level. So really gathered the community together, gathered a project team together, and figured out with the money we have, what can we build and design a scope around. We also did that in a fairly conservative way, knowing we didn't want to come back here asking for more money. We'd rather be in the situation we are now, where we have a little bit of savings and we're able to add extra pieces on when we were done. And the bulk of those major projects in the Jobs and Transportation Act, we approached that way.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I think this may be more of a question for my co-chairs, but and so maybe in that instance it's inappropriate, but is this, I'd like to get a feel on the jurisdictional transfers. We've got some good information, which I appreciate. And everybody seems to recognize it's an issue. It's an issue across the state. And it says there's a proposal in here for 1% gas tax. So I'm trying to get a feel for, is it anybody's priority? Is it important to the people in this room that we solve this problem, or are we going to hear a similar presentation 2 years or 4 years from now? So
I can answer that both from an opinion, mine, and from what I have observed in the Transportation Committee. And the opinion is, yes, this is a problem. There has been a proclivity to kick the can down the road because nobody wants this differential with the money. ODOT doesn't want to get stuck with a bunch of dogs. Conversely, local government doesn't. And so I believe that there will be a couple, and I mean that literally, a couple, maybe four jurisdictional transfers included in a transportation package. There's one that Mr. Mather made me aware of that they're well down the road on, and I have just forgotten where that was.
Madam Chair, it's in the packet, the one in Klamath County.
We've done quite
a bit of conversations with them. We haven't, you know, closed the deal, but we've had a lot of conversations with them over the years.
Southeast Powell is in play in some regard. The Cornelius Pass is in play in some regard. But there are not going to be a lot of them. And what my hope is that instead of just talking about this and not doing anything, that we will attempt a couple that represent transfers from local government to ODOT and ODOT to local government. And in doing so, develop the templates and the lessons learned that we need to then proceed to do others. And eventually figure out a funding source to try to make these whole, because in some cases these are highly problematic pieces of road segment, regardless of who owns them.
Correct.
Did I lie about anything, Mr. Garrett?
No, Madam Chair, you did not. I think you're spot on. I think the realities are we're trying to position ourselves for success. So you bring folks who want to actually make the deal. You just need maybe some skin to be put in the game to ensure that the math works at the end of the day. But there is a true understanding, I think, from all, that there is an evolution of these roadways. At once they may have had a statewide function, but they transition over time to more local roads. It's the perfect time to strike. Let's bring mutual parties together. We can make the math work, because that's where we normally trip. As the senator said, no one wants a liability. So how do you make the math work long term to make the transition and the transfer and have the appropriate jurisdiction oversee the activities on that piece of roadway? So I think it's a positive forward lean into this conversation, and I think the senator is exactly right, that I think if we're fortunate enough to breathe life into a funding package, there'll be some type of pilot that looks to animate a couple jurisdictional or several jurisdictional transfers.
The one other thing I might add before we leave this point is that expectations will have to be managed. I remember distinctly when the committee was out on the road and we were on doing these tours, and we were on Southeast Powell and lectured about the fact that that had to be completed 100% lest we would it be seen as abrogating our moral responsibility to those people. We all have problems. In every corner of the state, we have problems. And so expectations need to be managed, that these jurisdictional transfers, simply because a transfer occurs, does not magically mean 100% day after tomorrow. It means there's going to have to be some phasing, some planning, some long conversations about what the requirements are.
Madam Chair, you perfectly said it is a business transaction. The passions are there. Representative, certainly understand that better than I. The passions are there, but it is a business transaction, and that's the discipline I think local government ODOT can bring to this conversation.
One other thing I'll add is that jurisdictional transfers notwithstanding, there are some of us that are advocating to take a look at what constitutes a project of statewide significance and why it is at this moment that Multnomah County is solely responsible for the bridges that cross the Willamette in Portland that are clearly part of a transportation system. If one of those bridges goes down, we have significant systemic problems. And so there has been some discussion about creating a bridge authority or at least setting the table where the ownership of those bridges can be discussed. And I would submit there may be other bridges. I'm thinking, I just looked at Representative Gomberg, some of the coastal bridges that could be construed as contributing to the well-being of the entire system. So I think that conversation may occur as well within the confines of a package.
Well, if I may, just thank you for sharing that, because I really feel that encouraged by the understanding of everybody in this room of the significance of the issues, including the funding, including my neighborhood association. And so we'll let Senator Monroe work on the neighborhood associations and getting them straightened out. So.
Okay. Yes. All right. Mr. Mather, not so fast. Before you leave, and I don't know if this is specifically in your portfolio, but I'm going to view you as a target of opportunity. I'm going to take you back in time several biennia and remind you about OWIN. OWIN, the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, ultimately ended up in ODOT's portfolio. And frankly, I think you kind of got stuck holding the short straw. But I don't know what the current status of OWIN is. I don't know if the legislature fully understands the fiscal picture of OWIN right now. I don't know how close we are to the reality finish line versus the hypothesized finish line. And by that, I mean OWIN was supposed to allow first responders to speak to each other wherever they were. Originally, it was supposed to send data so the police officer in Pendleton could get the picture of the winsome little boy who had just been kidnapped. A lot of that is not coming true. And I would be quite curious to know, what's the status of OWIN?
Sure, Johnson. So the state radio program, as OWIN got redefined and handed to ODOT.
Let me just stop. You didn't expect this question. I didn't do you the courtesy of telling you I was going to ask it. I don't necessarily want you to fly from
right.
You know.
Right. So that redefined project, known as the state radio project, that ODOT was responsible for delivering, is nearing the very end of our project status for that. We've set the end of the biennium as the end of the project, and we'll take over more into the operation maintenance of the system. There are still elements that we'll still be doing as we shift from the project kind of status of it to the operation of the program, but for all intents and purposes, the state radio program will be done at the end of the biennium.
But I want to be clear, ODOT got stuck with this when the whole thing imploded. And I don't think that there should be any value judgments drawn. ODOT did the best they could in cleaning up a mess. But I would be curious to have, before we finish our budget time together, a summary of how much money has been spent, what got jettisoned along the way. I think that the legislature should not fool itself, and I'm looking at a former police officer, the legislature should not fool ourselves that we have solved the interoperability problem. In fact, quite the contrary. I think there may be expectations in the public safety sector that are unfulfilled, not ODOT's fault, but are unfulfilled, and lives could be in jeopardy if that project is not what it was first advertised to be. I would welcome your response.
Thank you. Being familiar with OWIN from an end user and watching the process prior to it being handed off to ODOT, which was probably unfortunate from taking on a project halfway through, but made sense to me from an infrastructure point of view, because that's what you do.
Right.
I'm curious as to where it is. I think one of the best things probably is that it quit being the headline. So my assumption is work's being done. I would be interested in that as I was working on regional stuff in Yamhill and Benton counties for a number of years with their PSAPs there. So just encouraged to see what that might look like. So that would be good.
Madam Chair, if I may, and Representative Noble, to your point, I'm proud of what this agency has done. There were trade-offs. When this project was handed to the agency...
Handed isn't the right word. Foisted on the agency.
When we received the project, it had a price tag of very close to $1 billion, $900+ million. There were difficult decisions made by a group of steadfast legislators who got in the back room saying, we can't afford this. This is what we can afford. And we came up with a budget of about $229 million. So as you migrate from a $900 million plus to $229, there are the trade-offs that Senator Johnson spoke to. I'm proud we're running through the tape on it. It's a good story. This agency did deliver that critical piece of communication infrastructure. We'd be happy to tell you that and tell you the story and to tell you what was left and what more there is to be done. There is little question there is. But here's what the money that we had, this is what we've delivered, and I think we've taken a step and we've made it a little bit safer for the men and women who are the first responders of this state. So,
I don't disagree with anything you said, and I want to add with an exclamation point, you guys got this handed to you and you delivered. There's no question about that. But I'd like to know how many people are still around, what the numbers look like, and then how broadly has it been shared with law enforcement, and they're ultimately the law enforcement and fire that we just saw going by here. They're ultimately the customer, and I don't know how the customer feels about the final product. And I'm just curious.
Good. We'll follow up.
Okay. Now you can escape.
Good. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if you're comfortable with it, we'd like to bring Mr. Gard up and start walking through some of the questions that were posed when Hal was up here a couple days ago.
Welcome back, Mr. Gard. Sign in, please.
Thank you, Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg. Hal Gard, I am the Administrator of the Rail and Public Transit Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thank you. I came away from our conversation last Thursday with 12 specific questions. I've got our smart people together, and we pulled together the answers to each of those. First question I heard was what percentage did BNSF pay for Wickiup Junction? How much did the railroad pay for Wickiup Junction? So that's the same question phrased two different ways. BNSF will contribute $7,480,000 on the overall project, and the total project cost $16,266,000, $16,266,590. Now, the railroad's contribution is set in federal law, and it's 5% of the cost of preliminary engineering, right-of-way, and construction of a grade-separated project when an at-grade crossing with train-activated warning devices is being eliminated and replaced by a new grade-separated structure. And the 5% is calculated in a specific manner in that federal regulation. The 5% is calculated based on the estimated costs of a theoretical highway profile that would be constructed if the railroad was not present. BNSF is not required to present its share of the costs until the at-grade crossing is physically and permanently closed.
So their part of this is $748,000 of a $16 million project.
That is correct.
And how'd the rest of it get paid for?
This is a region project. I don't think we contributed 10. We contributed between $4 and $8 million from the road crossing fund. The region are doing the upgrades through the normal state transportation improvement plan, Region 4.
I understand the value of having these safer crossings. I really do. But I just think that $748,000 against a total cost of $16 million hardly strikes me as equitable.
Duly noted.
Okay.
Second question I heard was when will all the lag screws, this relates to the Mosier discussion and the lag screws that held the plates on the curve track going into Mosier, when will all the lag screws be replaced statewide? They are scheduled to be replaced by the end of 2018. They've all been replaced in the gorge between John Day River and Troutdale. And just as an extra note, we continue to pay attention to those curves, and we are inspecting those intensively. Timing of train set purchase with Passenger Rail Improvement and Investment Act PREA. When was the decision made to purchase the train sets? The decision to purchase the train sets was approved by the Oregon Transportation Commission on July 23, 2009, using money that was available from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, that stimulus money. A reason for that decision was currently there were only five train sets that were in operation on the corridor. The three that are owned by WashDOT, the two that are owned by Amtrak. WashDOT, due to improvements that they were required to make and schedule increases that they were required to make under their acceptance of stimulus money, meant that they were going to withdraw their train sets from service in Oregon in order to be able to preserve service. The decision was made to buy the additional train sets in order to be able to maintain service in Oregon.
This would be a question I pose to Mr. Garrett. Was the commission fully informed? I don't think that I've seen such a stark display as the answers to the questions, Mr. Gard, that you answered, to realize how much money we've dropped into this whole thing and how expensive it would be to get out. And I'm sorry that I keep focusing in on the trains because I'm already getting all the nasty emails about it. But my curiosity is, when a decision of this magnitude is made, does the commission have the full array of what our obligations are, what our costs are, or is it just want to have train service to Eugene? I mean, the display that you presented to us, Mr. Gard, is so startling in how much money we've spent. I'm just curious, what's the fullness of the decision-making process?
Madam Chair, it's a legitimate question, but I remember this conversation. It took place in Forest Grove, and it was a very healthy conversation with four commissioners. We had one commissioner, Mike Nelson, who was ill and didn't attend. But the conversation was intense. It was robust. As a matter of fact, Transportation Commissioner Alan Brown voted against it because he thought the 30-some million dollars should have been placed on the road because that federal stimulus dollar was fairly flexible, could go either way. But I will tell you, consistent with the 2006 Oregon Transportation Plan, with the emphasis of being multimodal, to look at the transportation system as a whole, and with the Commission Chair Gail Ackerman, Commission Member Janice Wilson, and Commission Member Dave Lallman, there was little question that they wanted to make the investment. With Washington saying, we're going to pull those trains, that would have left us with nothing. And what we knew is if indeed we were to get out of the train, the passenger rail train set business, it would be extremely problematic and maybe cost prohibitive to get back in. So I think with the policy decision the commission had committed to just 2-3 years earlier, with that extensive lean on being multimodal, there was little question that they thought it was the right thing to do. Now, did we know how much with PREA that actually kicked in 2013? Where the state had to begin covering these types of expenditures. Did we know the full extent of that? I don't think we did. I think we had an idea of what it would cost. I think the realities are it costs more, and that's why we make a general fund request over the last couple biennium. But again, if you look at the history of passenger rail train in the state of Oregon, general fund has flown in, or flowed in, I should say, and flowed out as a revenue stream over the years. I think our commission understood that, but the healthy discussion was we cannot afford to lose it, because once we lose it, we'll never be able to get back into it. And that was the sentiment of the commission. They were strong, they were steadfast, save one commissioner who thought there was a better expenditure on the road.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
A little more to the story. We took advantage of an opportunity. Washington State Department of Transportation was in the process of purchasing two Talgo train sets. It was part of a stimulus package in that state, and they were having those train sets built and assembled in Milwaukee. So we added our order onto them with the idea of saving quite a bit of money in project management costs and ultimately in testing costs. Now, that didn't work out that way. And just to kind of jump ahead a little bit, the reason it didn't work out that way is there was a change in political leadership in Wisconsin right in this era. And when Governor Scott Walker came on board, he returned the ERA money that came to the state of Wisconsin and basically shut down that operation. That resulted in a pretty expensive piece of litigation for Wisconsin. Also handed us the responsibility for testing those train sets. Now, the testing protocols, and I'm moving on to question number four, the testing protocols are clearly laid out in federal regulation in 49 CFR 238. And it's basically, you mentioned that you can buy a helicopter off the showroom floor and it's certified and ready to go. It doesn't work that way with train sets that are carrying passengers. And those train sets, if they're new to service, the train sets need to be statically tested to make sure that everything works, like the brakes in a concert. They need to be dynamically tested so that they know that they operate safely at the design speeds that they were built for. And then they have to be tested on the corridor in which they're supposed to operate on, because each corridor has its own unique geometry, has its own unique track condition, structure. And so those protocols all became the responsibility of ODOT.
I'll buy all of the, you know, unique corridor, blah, blah, blah. But the fact that Talgo could sell a train that didn't have brakes that worked just takes my breath away. I also got a snarling email lecturing me about how all the helicopters that I purchased, the example that I used, were all subsidized by the government. Last time I checked, Bell Helicopter Textron is a private company. But the point of the story here is I didn't realize until this conversation that... is that because this is a European train, or is there something special about them that it seems to me brakes are foundational to operating a vehicle that stops and goes?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, any new piece of equipment operating on the state rail lines hauling passengers has to be demonstrated that you can stop a large, fast piece of equipment in the appropriate distance and time, place, and you're stopping a lot of joined cars. And actually, brake work is one of the areas we spend an awful lot of time working with FRA around.
Okay.
Thank you. The other question that we had out of that conversation is how much will it cost to get out of the contracts? As I mentioned earlier, we have termination agreements in all of our contracts, and we have slightly different time frames. For Talgo, it's 90 days of notice. For cause or lack of funding. With Amtrak, it's 180-day notice. The specific termination cost, we believe, is a range between $3 million and $3.5 million. And what goes into that? There are just some things that need to be wrapped up. So people have advanced ticket costs. Is that a rebate, or are we going to maintain service until all of those are used up? There are amortized costs where we have spare parts that we, you know, order ahead of time that have been ordered that would need to be covered or canceled. Same thing with consumables, the kind of things that go into the train, the fluids, that type of material.
But if I understand the rest of your display, this is kind of how the question gets answered, how you are asked, how you answer it. Because if I understand your display, the 3 to 3.5 is a fraction of the costs.
There are other elements to it that I'm getting to, Chair Johnson.
So the point of my story is, and I'm not trying to be a jerk about this, but it isn't 3 to 3.5 if we were to stop tomorrow. It's a huge number.
Well, Chair Johnson, so what I'm trying to articulate, to the best of my ability, is there are several steps and ongoing costs associated depending upon which choice we make. So, you know, if we are able to give, just for example, and they have not expressed any interest and have certainly been noncommittal, but if we were able to arrange an agreement with Washington State to pick up those trains, that ought to satisfy our financial obligations with FTA. That would hopefully result in an agreement that they would pick up our spare parts. They would continue to use them in the service they're providing. There is no guarantee of that, but that would have a different cost amount than if we could not find a willing recipient or could not find a willing buyer and we were forced to mothball those trains and store them until we could find a willing buyer. There's a different cost associated with that. So there's a lot of variables that play out, but our estimate, given, you know, certain scenarios, is a range.
Well, then I would respectfully suggest that the range would go all the way from $3 million to $33 million. I just think that the answer to this question is somewhat misleading in its brevity.
That was not our intent, and I apologize.
But how to the point? Let's do the math. I think that's what the senator really asked, where there's a clarity of math. And as Senator, I think your scale actually is the 3 to 3.5. 237, because the 3 3.5, that's one aspect. The other 3.5, where we talk about the discontinuation, where you have a recommissioning cost of 2.8, which totals up to another 3.5, that's another 3.5 on top of the 3.5, so we're at 7. And then we can talk about the $33 million, which is the prorate amount, or the depreciation of the train, that if we can't find a willing buyer, receiver for the train set, then we'd have to reimburse the Federal Transit Association that stimulus money here. So you're exactly right. It is a reach of from 3 to 40 in total. Three separate transactions that we're trying to break down in our answer here. So a little clunky. I understand exactly what you're talking to, but make no mistake, there is a significant price to pay. And we haven't even spoken about, as I spoke to earlier, about the commission decision. You know, one day we might want to get back into the train system, and we've got costs associated with that, but that's somewhat grasping at specters and beyond, I think, the specifics of your question.
I guess, colleagues, the point that I'm trying to make is, as often happens in this building, a Rubicon gets crossed where you have spent so much money that you can't escape. That happened with OWIN, the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network. We got to a point where going back would have left so much money on the table. And in seeing the totality of this display, that's kind of how it strikes me with a train.
Thank you.
But keep going.
Thank you. Additional question, develop the financial display, funding sources for passenger rail that includes funds to subsidize payments and payments to Amtrak, which we have done so.
Wait, what number are you on?
I am on question number 6.
Okay, well, 5, colleagues, I think gives you more clarity in the kind of cumulative effect that Director Garrett was speaking of, concluding with $33 million.
Okay.
Senator Hansel.
Just want to get out of the train business, is that we're talking about 5, right? That's $33 million would be the cost of the state, is what I'm hearing.
Could be, depending on the scenario.
Chair Johnson, Senator Hansel.
First case scenario.
If we were not able to give our trains away to an FTA recipient, then we would need to pay back the Federal Transit Administration the money that they granted to us to purchase those trains at a depreciated cost. And right now that's estimated at $33 million.
It calls to mind Senator Hansel's question, does we used to have service in Eastern Oregon. And it seemed to me, again, this is sort of lost in the mists of time, that the decision to terminate that was sort of made like that.
Absolutely.
And, and not a lot of warning to the community, and just, we're done.
This, Madam Chair, it may seem that way. I had the privilege, before I came to ODOT, to work for Mark Hatfield. United, fought very hard to keep the Empire Builder. Very, very hard. Extensive conversations with Amtrak. But that rail line that traveled I-84 to Eastern Oregon was hemorrhaging about $19 million a year. It just couldn't make it work when all was said and done. The passions were there. The senator, a couple times, saved the train, but it became a financial situation. So a very difficult conversation for those folks that were boarding and trying to move east to west or west to east. Difficult conversation, but I just was privy to that difficult conversation that when all was said and done over the length of time, I think it ended with Senator Wyden doing his very best to try to keep the Empire Builder and fighting to keep it on, but I think it was a financial conversation that actually put an end to that that train set.
Senator Hatfield.
I think in the timing, it was concluded 6 months after Senator Hatfield retired.
Thank you for that historical footnote. All right.
Moving on, I did provide a spreadsheet that, in as much detail as we could provide, a total costs of operating the train since as far back as we could go. This is the only piece, and I just for full disclosure and clarity, that we could not get definitive answers on are what our payments to Amtrak were. Between 1994 and 1998. And I have budgeted costs, but they were not expenses, so they are not included on this spreadsheet. That amount is about $10 million. But the spreadsheet in front of you actually does include all payments to UP for both the initial service startup and the second round trip that we added in 2000. And I'm just going to cut to the chase. And the total amount of money that we've spent since we started service is $192,067,313. That's our total amount that we've expended.
And you started service in 19...
We had a partial year in... Chair Johnson, we had a partial year in 1994. Our first full year of service was in 1995.
Okay. So in ostensibly 20 years, we've spent almost $200 million.
That's correct, Chair Johnson.
Okay.
The next follow-up on that question is, did we pay Union Pacific Railroad for improvements? And the answer is yes. This was an odd little piece of history that we had to dredge up. We paid for all of our improvements, the actual payments for both the initial startup and the second round trip occurred in the 03-05 timeline, and we have a memorandum of agreement between the division and the Union Pacific Railroad, and I do not understand and I have no knowledge of why there was such a long lag time between that initial service startup in 1994 and why those payments didn't start occurring until 03. But the bottom line is, for the initial startup service, we paid Union Pacific Railroad $8,100,000, and that started in 1999 to 2001 biennium. And then for the second round trip, we paid $15 million starting in 2003 and continue to make payments until the 11-13 timeframe on those investments.
Thank you.
Okay. Question number 7, how much Connect Oregon went to the Class 1 railroads? We've reimbursed the Class 1 railroads $30,265,417 through the Connect program. $24.5 million of that went to the Union Pacific Railroad, and BNSF received about $5.7 million. All reimbursements for Class 1 projects through Connect Oregon 5 have been made. We have one outstanding agreement for only one Class 1 project, which was approved for funding for Connect 6, but it has not yet been signed, and there's been no payments yet.
And if memory serves me correctly, that project, or amalgam of projects, took one quarter about of the available funds. The point of my story is the Class 1s have done okay by the state of Oregon, and I just wonder, in this fabulous partnership on the train, how much that's been appreciated and acknowledged. If in fact we're partners, doesn't appear that there's much of a partnership here.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I'm not an apologist for the railroads. It's not my job and not my interest. I simply want to share that in conversations that I've had with them, that Connect Oregon has been of great interest to them because it changes their return on investment and the type of money that we'll spend in this state.
I can think of 30 million reasons that it would be important to them.
Okay. I hope I haven't lost my spot. No, moving on. Question number 9, I'm moving on to transit and questions are around the point service. Oregon Point runs 5 routes. Where do we currently have point service was the question. Oregon Point service runs on 5 routes, totaling 1.3 million service miles in 2015, serving 39 communities throughout the state. And we've included a map to demonstrate where those connections are in your materials. And it's broken out into 5 discrete service sections. There's the Cascades section. It's our highest ridership with our highest fare box recovery rate. And that's the Cascades component, which runs up and down the I-5 corridor with the intention of augmenting the schedules for our trains. So the idea is just to add additional schedules for that route. It makes the stops at the train stations and ties us into a Portland Union station. The Northwest Point is our second highest ridership. running from Astoria to Portland on 26. And again, we enjoy a very high fare box recovery of nearly 80% on that section.
When you initiated that, is there a record of conversations that were had with Sunset Empire? Because you're coming into their territory with your stops in Seaside, Gearhart, Warrenton, and Astoria. Is the service so dissimilar that there was no need to coordinate with them, or were they given the opportunity to comment on the efficacy of you starting service in their territory?
So, Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I am not aware of a record of conversations, and I have asked my folks. However, I have had numerous conversations with most of the service providers where point is provided, and they all see it as an augmentation of service and are highly supportive, and it is very, very different. It's a premium express service, moving people pretty quickly as opposed to a local multi-stop network. And it actually operates on a different highway entirely, so it's actually spreading out service. Again, we have an eastern service, much lower ridership, much lower fare box recovery, but pretty important to those folks. We have a high desert service. And then finally, we have the southwest service that connects the lower part of the state.
And I'm curious, do those California cities that are serviced contribute anything?
Chair Johnson, they do not.
I guess inquiring minds would like to know why Oregon money is servicing four California cities.
Chair Johnson, that is the route to get to the lower part of Oregon, and if folks walk in and buy a ticket, we're happy to let them take an empty
Wrong
seat.
Answer, Mr. Gard.
Pardon me.
Have we solicited? They're getting a benefit. Oregonians are paying for it. Have we solicited some skin in the game from them?
Chair Johnson, to the best of my knowledge, we have not.
Why? Okay, colleagues, I just want to remind everybody of this. When we've got Transit in here singing the blues about there's never enough money, we're taking care of four California cities with Oregon taxpayer money. And not asking for any participation.
Point taken.
Okay, let's not beat this one to death.
Question 11. Where are the approximately 1,000 buses in this state, and are they getting help with selecting the right size buses?
I want to go back to Point for a second.
Okay.
What's the source of money for Point?
Chair Johnson, member of the committee. We've broken it out. We use primarily federal money, and this is rural access money. Across the state, we have a breakdown across it, and I got it broken down by particular point services. And then four areas where we've got a high percentage of elderly and disabled riders, we contribute some STF money, so that those folks are able to take that long-distance intercity network.
Do you have projections that shows the sustainability of this service over time?
Chair Johnson, quite frankly, projections is not the right word, but we are confident that we will continue to have federal funds in order to be able to provide this service.
As confident as you were with the trains? You should have seen that one coming.
I should have.
Okay, let's move on.
Okay. Question number 11. Where are the approximately 1,000 buses in the state, and are they getting help with selecting the right size buses? We provided a chart. This ranges everywhere from counties to individual service providers to small retirement homes. The vast majority.
Stop. Why should you be providing a for-profit retirement home bus?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, it is an eligible expense, and the intent is to provide anybody who can operate and get those needed citizens to essential services. We are happy to provide the means for those folks to be able to do that. A lot of those retirement communities are operating on a shoestring, and the receipt of a bus and a volunteer driver is just what it takes to be able to get people out of the retirement home, get them into shopping, get them into medical appointments. It's a very common rural service across the state.
You've said volunteer driver, and I'm very supportive of the notion of volunteer drivers, but who's responsible for making sure that the driver shows up ready to go to work, that they're not drunk or that they're not out of a medical, or where does that liability reside?
Chair Johnson, Entity, the recipient of the funds, is ultimately responsible for ensuring that they've got drivers and that those folks are properly trained. We provide training. We provide oversight, not on a daily basis, but on a regular check-in basis. We try to make sure that folks are safe and in appropriate vehicles and are treated in the way they need to be. We participate in large statewide training efforts in terms of securement. That's a very large component, so that you make sure that if people are wheelchair bound, they're able to get on and off the bus in a safe fashion and properly secured on the bus. So there's quite a bit of effort that goes into making sure that folks are being safely transported across the state. I just wanted to point out that the vast majority of the vehicles that are purchased with ODOT funds and that we hold fee title to fall in the medium-sized light-duty category and the small light-duty. And small light-duty is essentially an ADA-accessible van, the smallest, most economical. The trade-off there is that they don't tend to have the longevity of larger vehicles, but they're usually appropriate for the majority of elderly and disabled service that is provided across the state.
And do you require maintenance logs for all of these, or trip logs, or any way to make sure somebody hasn't taken the bus to Reno for the weekend? Or
Chair Johnson, yes, we have, and actually we've been quite aggressive. We've had, I'm not going to mention the county's names, but we've had a couple of rural counties who maybe were a little free with the use of their vehicles, and we have had very strong conversations in making sure that they understood the rules of use of those vehicles and the appropriate maintenance. Okay, moving on. Final question that I selected is, what's the relationship with Portland State University for the Oregon Public Transportation Plan and the KPM? Was it bid? How was Portland study being funded? We contracted directly with Portland State University for the update of the previous study. Really, the idea was to make sure that we had some consistency in the method and consistency in the approach. Portland State is updating two reports, the needs, costs, and funding alternatives for transportation services for older adults and people with disabilities in urban and rural Oregon. They're updating the Rural Transit in Oregon Current Needs and Future Needs work that was originally published in 2010. We expect a final product this summer. Total cost of the work is $165,000, and it's being funded by the Special Transportation Fund.
Colleagues, any questions of Ms. Gardner? Senator Hansel.
I just thank you for your systematic approach of answering the questions, showing us the charts, and that's very helpful. Thank you.
Chair Johnson, Senator Hansel, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to bring up Robert Gebhardt, who is the Central Service Administrator. Again, Central Services at the Oregon Department of Transportation really is the administrative arm of the agency. And Mr. Gebhardt will quickly walk through the pieces of his portfolio with his presentation, and at the conclusion that would provide the overview of the agency that we brought to this committee.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Gebhardt, Administrator for Central Services, the Administrative Support Division within the Oregon Department of Transportation. Today I have the privilege of presenting an overview of the services provided to the agency by the Division 7 support branches and ODOT headquarters. And I will tell you about some of the division budget drivers and improvement initiatives, as well as offer some brief commentary on the agency's management of delinquent receivables, pursuant to some interest that's been expressed by the committee in recent hearings. Support services branches within Central Services include audit services, business services, facilities, financial services, human resources, information services, and the ODOT procurement office. The audit services branch performs both internal and external audits. External audits are performed on contractors to ensure they are following state and federal laws and regulations, and also that they are billing for services in an appropriate manner. Our internal audit function is performed on department programs and business units, primarily to identify business risk and appropriate strategies to mitigate or eliminate them, as well as to identify areas where process improvements may be implemented to improve efficiency and effectiveness of agency programs. The Business Services Branch is responsible for ODOT document management and the coordination of agency policies and procedures. The office also helps coordinate agency-wide information gathering when responding to public records requests, and also provides graphic design, photo, video, and reprographic services across ODOT, as well as for other state agencies. Our facilities branch operates and maintains ODOT-owned and leased facilities, primarily in Salem and Portland, and they also provide planning and project management for major maintenance, capital improvement, capital construction projects for ODOT facilities statewide. The facilities branch performs all accounting functions of the agency to include payroll and payable processing, accounts receivable collections, and statewide financial reporting. The branch also administers the bonding program and is responsible for management of the fuels tax system. The human resources branch provides consulting and support to ODOT business units in the areas of recruitment, classification, performance management, labor relations, collective bargaining, and succession planning.
Let me stop and ask you a question there. Do you see any redundancy in the fact that the Department of Administrative Services provides all of these services as well? They do human services, they do employee relations, they do the collective bargaining. Why is it that ODOT would elect to have their own internal, and I'm an agnostic, that's not true. I'm looking for cost savings, but I'm just curious why it is that you would elect to have ODOT assume these costs if the services were available from DAS.
Yes, Chair Johnson, I think there's the perception of incredible redundancy, but I tell you that each agency really has some unique needs, and again, the mission charted for the agency, and some of the, for instance, in information services, there's the evidence of security-related work being done by the OSCIO, the state CIO's office, as well as security being done within the agency. There are separate duties. They aren't entirely on the same track in that the services that are performed within the agency are for rights to and from access to systems, as well as looking at unique agency needs for investigation purposes, et cetera. And human resources, hiring and recruitment and those kinds of things are unique needs for the agency. Statewide, I'm not aware that DAS is hiring for the benefit of all agencies. They do hire for some of the smaller agencies to provide those services.
I believe you're correct. Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have kind of a related question. What part of your budget, the central services budget, is a DAS assessment or other DAS payments?
Yes, Chair Johnson, Representative Nierman. We've got DAS assessment in the current budget of just about 25% of our total central services budget. At the present time.
And that's just, can I follow, Madam Chair?
Follow.
And that's just the DAS assessment then. Do you have any other payments to DAS that are over and above that? I'm thinking like state data center charges, or I don't know how that works, or phone system charges, or anything else that's above the assessment?
Yes, Chair Johnson, Representative Nierman. The number I was giving you was all in. That's all in assessment, including state government service charges.
Okay, thank you.
In human resources, they also manage diversity and affirmative actions programs for the agency, and coordinate a provision and provision a full array of employee training and development offerings for agency staff. The Information Systems Branch provides business technology systems planning, development, and support.
How are you managing your training now? Arguably, it was 3,000 years ago when I worked for ODOT, but back in the middle to late 90s, the idea was that the Muhammad always came to the mountain. Everybody that was in the ODOT family would all come to Salem for training. Have you made any improvements in how you're using electronic means or video training? I'm thinking of folks that live over in Senator Hansel's neck of the woods who spend a day driving here, a day training, and a day driving home, and the week shot. Could you talk about your use of technology in disseminating training that doesn't require everybody to come here?
Yes, Chair Johnson. Depending on the training type, we use multimedia. We have computer-based training. We have train-the-trainer concepts where we send people to training, and their responsibility is to come back to the unit and offer training to the business unit or region. We have people will come in for new employee orientation quite often because there's something to be said for being at headquarters, receiving training and hearing from leaders, and then going back out into the region and getting your on-site training as an addendum to what you received at headquarters. So the short answer to your question is we use all modes and mediums possible.
Okay.
Our information services branch provides business technology systems planning, development, and support for the entire agency, as well as maintenance and support services for agency computers, printers, and communications devices. The branch is also responsible for system security and related forensics work, which continues to be a high visibility area across the statewide enterprise, as well as the subject of a current governor's executive order and legislation under consideration during this legislative session. We also provide project management support for major technology projects throughout the department. We're working with DMV on their service transformation program, and are also collaborating with the financial services branch in a multi-agency project to implement a time and attendance management system, also known as TAMS.
Time and attendance management system, what does that mean to the layperson?
Yeah, it's time and attendance, really being able to streamline payroll functioning, entering your time, setting schedules, tracking employee attendance for payroll purposes. Okay. Our seventh business unit of the division is the ODOT Procurement Office, which provides procurement and contracting services for professional services, goods and trade services, public improvements and construction, and interagency agreements. The office
is. What are the limits of non-bid contracts that you can do out of procurement? Is there a dollar threshold?
I'm sorry, Chair Johnson, that's not coming to mind, but we can get to.
What I'm trying to figure out is the updo of, or the redo, the update of the transit work. Goes as a no bid to Portland State. I'm just curious, it's $160,000. When is there a financial threshold that would require you to bid that work?
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that for no bid, the level is $5,000. You can pretty much just select someone. As you rise above it, there are different thresholds, and I think we're at $100,000, maybe $150,000. We'll get back to you on specific where we can actually target maybe three type firms who conduct that type of service, and then anything above that, we have to go up to the RFPs here. The PSU thing may be a continuation of an existing contract, and that 160 may be a combination of several.
I'd like to know how many open contracts ODOT has right now with PSU.
Got it.
Please continue.
Forgive me, I lost my place.
You were in procurement.
Right.
Yes, ma'am. The office is responsible for developing and publishing requests for proposals and requests for information, and running solicitation processes, evaluating bids, and then developing and assisting with negotiations of contracts and price agreements. The office also provides training for ODOT staff in all phases of procurement, contract administration, and contract management. Within ODOT headquarters reside the Office of Civil Rights, Office of Innovative Partnerships, Communications, Legislative Budget Services, and the Government Relations sections that provide budget and policy development counsel and services to agency leadership and stakeholders.
Who's the manager of the Innovative Partnerships section right now?
Madam Chair, it's a young woman by the name of Erica McCartan. Excuse me, she changed her name. Erica Dinsdale. I apologize. Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
I'll move on now to budget drivers and improvement efforts within the division. Given that the Central Services Division is affected by and serves all of ODOT, our primary driver is the support requirements for sister divisions. One significant factor we must consider in support services delivery is the need to continually upgrade and modernize technology systems and business processes to support ever-increasing emphasis on efficiency and the use of big data. Another is the need to attract and retain a diverse workforce that is equipped to perform new work required as a result of new technologies and information management analysis requirements. Improvement efforts across the division include implementation by the financial services branch of a new automated fuels tax system that has allowed for enhanced revenue tracking and reporting, as well as electronic filing for users that reduces administrative burden, speeds processing, and allows licensees to file for multiple jurisdictions under a single master license number. In the human resources arena, our recruiters are now using data mining and analytics to pursue passive candidates via LinkedIn, allowing them to identify potentially qualified candidates for difficult-to-fill ODOT positions and conduct outreach efforts to make them aware of these opportunities. The Information Systems Branch has contracted with a third-party firm to manage two key mobile communications device contracts for the agency, and this focused effort has yielded biennium to date savings of nearly $500,000. And also, the Central Services Division Leadership Team has recently launched an initiative creating the Central Services Performance System with intent to deepen engagement with the ODOT divisions and partners we serve. This work includes establishing clear understanding of the division's service commitments in alignment with the ODOT mission, values, and strategic direction, and the creation of performance metrics and review processes that foster disciplined performance management and continuous improvement. And to wrap up, I'd like to offer just a few comments on ODOT collections efforts and some interagency work we have been involved in aimed at mitigating risks and receivables management for agencies. At the end of fiscal year 2016, ODOT reported $10.2 million in delinquent receivables, representing 2.3% of the total receivable amount due at that time of $443.5 million. We can assure you that robust efforts are made at all times to collect all monies due to the agency. For example, 50% of the delinquent receivables reported at that time were in the motor carrier portfolio. And our collectors in the financial services branch are working closely with the division to take advantage of statutory leverage available that allows the suspension of accounts for trucking firms with delinquent tax obligations, leaving them subject to citations for continuing to travel within the state while delinquent. There also exists the ability to deny, cancel, or revoke authority when we learn that a given firm has reorganized but contains assets or principals of a formerly delinquent entity. And finally, in some situations where they don't have quite enough leverage to require payment of an old debt from a reorganized firm, the motor carrier division has the ability to mitigate future risk by requiring a deposit or a highway use tax bond in situations where it is felt that the risk of performance justifies such. We apply similar diligence to collection efforts in all delinquent debts due to the agency and are affirmed somewhat by the fact that efforts by third-party collection agencies have not yielded significant recoveries after our internal collection efforts have been exhausted. Regarding comparative work done by agencies at inception of new contract or vendor relationships, I can report to you that a tax compliance verification process was implemented for the Connect Oregon program in 2015. That required all applicants to obtain from the Department of Revenue a statement indicating full tax compliance and no delinquent obligations. The Department of Revenue was very responsive in providing compliance certifications with a very quick turnaround. The process revealed three firms that were non-compliant at the time of application submission, and all three applicants were able to get into full compliance in time to continue with the Connect Oregon process. Finally, we have been participating with the Departments of Revenue and Administrative Services in a vendor offset pilot program. The work has sought to identify reliable comparative data sets that may inform garnishment processes to offset delinquent tax obligations of vendors with payments that may be due to them from another agency. Compatibility between the data sets thus far has been unreliable, but the work continues to resolve some of the data matching issues. The ODOT Procurement Office and Financial Services Branch will remain engaged in this work, as led by the Department of Revenue. And this concludes my review of ODOT Central Services. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Co-Chair Gomberg, I just see a question brewing at you.
Oh, thank you so much, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you for wrapping up with those comments about our efforts to identify contractors working for you that owe money to other people. And I'm surprised you only found three, but I think that's positive news, and I appreciate your attention to it. Let's go back to the larger question of delinquent debt. And you said that you were making efforts, and you indicated that some of those are farmed out to collection agencies. What I'm seeing for the previous year is that we've got about $10 million on account right now. Certainly a lot less than other agencies, and perhaps not that consequential in terms of the total number of dollars you're dealing with, but still, Oregonians would say we can fill a lot of potholes with $10 million. So what's the big picture? Which parts of your agency are acquiring this debt?
Yes, Co-Chair Johnson, and Comberg, as I indicated, about 50% of that $10.2 million is in the motor carrier portfolio. And one of the things that Amy Ramsdell, the administrator of the division, has indicated or articulated to me is that they aggressively pursue, and it is not uncommon to see many truckers reconstitute themselves or continue to travel within the state, even with delinquent obligations. But as they aggressively pursue them, and they use all methods possible to collect those debts. And when organizations reconstitute, they use available leverage to collect from the new entity that might have been formed for that purpose. But I'd say that we aggressively pursue those dollars.
Follow up? Please. Well, I appreciate that, and I think we should be aggressive. What I'm also seeing is that our additions to your account actually grew faster than your collections did this year. So in spite of us being aggressive, we seem to be losing ground. Any sense of why that may be? And I'll say that that we're talking about collections of about $5.4 million versus, additions, new debt of $5.4 million versus collections of about $3.8 million. So losing a little bit of ground there.
Representative Gomberg, I don't have an explanation for why we're losing ground. I can assure you, however, that the efforts continue.
Right. One final question, Madam Co-Chair.
Follow up.
And that has to do with, I think, the most interesting aspect of this whole subject, and that is our write-offs. That the agency wrote off a little better than $2 million this past year. So do you have any explanation for what's going on when we just simply say, we can't find that money, and we're just going to take it off the books?
I think that we do take it off the books when we've exhausted all available efforts, to include the use of outside firms, lien searches, skip tracing, whatever is possible to us and available to us as a collection technique or available method. And at times when you reach and have exhausted all efforts, I think those are the times at which we exercise the write-off.
All right. Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, I find this write-off subject really very interesting. I'd be interested in not singling out this agency, but getting a broader report to our committees at the end of each year of what on earth is going on with the amount of money we're writing off, why we're writing it off, and who's making those decisions.
I see a priority, Bill.
if I may, Madam Chair and Co-Chair Gomberg, it's a legitimate ask. It's an ask I've made of my agency. It certainly is the last card that we play, and I think Mr. Gebhardt has articulated, we exhaust all the avenues here, but there is a definite process and protocol that we follow, and there are times there's nowhere else to look. But I think it's important to have that greater conversation, because if it's not only the Department of Transportation, but it's an enterprise conversation, do all my brothers and sisters follow a discipline protocol here? They should. My guess is they probably do, but I don't assume. I know my agency does, because this is an area that you have provided some leadership on over the last couple biennium. We've tightened up not only in motor carrier, we've tightened up in the highway as we chase those folks that may do damage to our asset. We try to find those as to why the incoming is greater than, or the incoming is greater than the retrieving. Could be big time hits that we have taken. But I think we deserve an answer or you deserve an answer to that, and I'll follow up on that as to why there is a little bit of an inequity there, right, especially since this has been a focus of the agency over the last couple years.
Thank you. I do recognize that, Director, and I think we're making some progress. And you're right. There are a lot of different kinds of reasons why agencies write off debt. Madam Co-Chair, I queried one agency in another committee. They told me they stopped chasing people when they died. My response was, there's always some excuse out there somewhere. So.
All right. Two things of interest to me, and we can follow up with this in a written response. I am interested in how much money comes off the top, for lack of a better word, that Central Services takes off before the distribution to our partners, local government. For example, the $100 million DMV modernization program, I think, does not go through the formula. It's taken off the top, and I'd like to know what else is. And then I want to visit with you a little bit, and by saying that, I mean you respond to the professional staff, and they'll disseminate it to the rest of the committee, about your ending balance carry forward, how much that generally is, and its genesis, its flexibility, those sorts of questions.
You bet.
So with that, in the remaining 3 minutes, let us turn to the Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Whittakin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Linnea Whittakin with DAS Chief Financial Office, and I will be brief. You're familiar with the presentation. I just want to highlight really two slides. That is the governor's budget expenditure history. The biggest change you'll see is an 8% increase from 15-17 to 17-19. The biggest portion of this increase is the $71 million investment in Connect Oregon 7. This is a $45 million increase over last biennium. There's also a general fund increase in an effort to continue reimbursement for the state radio project and to continue to pay down the debt service that ODOT has been covering for state police. And this is in about $24 million. The other slide I want to highlight is just the overall investments that the governor's budget makes. These are Connect Oregon 7, the DMV service transformation project, the state radio project debt service payback, capital construction for the Toledo maintenance station, and then the statewide adjustments updated to DAS price service list.
Colleagues,
with that, any questions?
Any questions? All right. Thank you. We made it. Mr. Jolivet.
So Monday will be, not Monday. Sorry, tomorrow will be public testimony.
Okay. Colleagues, anything for the good of the order? There being none, we're adjourned.